evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this pre-recorded program via remote from Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, August 31st, 2020. A coalition of rebel groups have signed an agreement with the Sudanese government.
We view it as the beginning of the continuation and commitment of the parties to honor and implement the agreement in letter and spirit.
And Muslims in South Sudan have reopened mosques.
COVID-19 is still there. We have to take the measures. When we came to the mosque today, a lot of people were wearing masks. That's good. Social distancing, no shaking hands, no greeting. At least you greet someone from a far place.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Sudan's transitional government and a coalition of rebel groups have signed a comprehensive agreement in the South Sudanese capital, Juba. The agreement, brokered by South Sudan, includes power sharing, security arrangements, and wealth sharing. The head of the Sudanese Sovereign Council, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, his deputy, General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, and the Sudanese Prime Minister, Abdullah Hamdok, signed the agreement. For VOA News, Naba Mohyeddin reports from Khartoum.
Sudan's transitional government signed the peace deal Monday with the Sudan Revolutionary Front, SRF, a coalition of rebel groups from the regions of Darfur, Southern Kordofan, and the Blue Nile. The historic agreement made after a year of talks hosted by South Sudan offers power sharing, integration into security forces, land rights, and the return of those displaced from years of conflict. Two rebel factions within the Sudan Liberation Movement, SLM, and the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, North, SPLMN, refused to take a part in the peace process. But Sudan's transitional government spokesman Faisal Saleh still praised the deal. He says peace is the first priority out of 10 issues the transitional government has determined to begin addressing. He says since last September, a delegation went to Juba and announced the Juba Declaration. Saleh says the transitional government is happy to accomplish this step, but they are aware that still more rounds of talks will be needed with SLM and SPLMN to hopefully achieve a comprehensive peace. The rebel fought troops sent by former President Omar al-Bashir, who was ousted by the military in April 2019 after a month of popular protest, and replaced with a joint military-civilian government. Bashir is serving jail time for corruption and is wanted by the International Criminal Court, ICC, for genocide and crimes against humanity in Darfur. Sudan's delegation to Monday's signing ceremony included Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok and the head of the Transitional Sovereign Council, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. But the deal was signed by Sudan's commander of fighters in the conflict, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, known as Himeti, who rights groups say committed many of the abuses in Darfur. Himeti and Burhan were also blamed for attacks against anti-Bashir protesters in Khartoum in June 2019 and left over 120 people dead. Protest leaders agreed to a power-sharing deal with the military, whereby Sudan is to hold its first democratic election in decades in 2022. Naba Mohyeddin for VUA News, Khartoum.
Some Sudanese on the streets of the capital Khartoum have welcomed the signing of the comprehensive peace agreement between the Sudanese transitional government and some rebel groups operating in Darfur and Blue Nile states. Some residents of the capital say a peaceful Sudan will pave way for development. The residents who spoke to VOA are also calling on the international community to support the implementation of the peace agreement and help Sudan move forward. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
Khartoum resident Khadija Idris of the Arkawit neighborhood calls the peace deal one of the achievements of the Sudanese revolution. Idris says people will now be able to move about freely, and she says the excessive amount of money spent on buying guns and ammunition will now go toward delivering services, including health and education.
Resources that have been spent on fighting each other should now be directed to development projects. Citizens will be able to exchange goods, trade experience, and they are free to move between states. So peace will have a lot of positivity on the citizens.
Muhammad Tahir Ahmad is the paramount chief of the Jimelab community in Kassala, Eastern Sudan. Speaking by phone from Kassala town, Tahir calls the signing of the peace deal a victory over war and destruction.
This is a big victory, and what we hope to see is a genuine implementation during the transitional period of 3 years. The parties to the agreement need to adhere and fully implement all articles of the agreement. We don't want to go to the national elections when we still have fighting in some parts of the country.
Atahir says people took up arms in Darfur, Blue Nile, Southern Kordofan and Eastern Sudan because they felt marginalized under the rule of Oster President Omar al-Bashir. During that time, he says, there was no fair distribution of resources and power lay in the hands of few political elites. Even though the government and the armed groups have agreed to stop fighting, Atahir says the international community should show its commitment by funding the deal's implementation.
All these regions need serious development, and we are expecting the international community to consider supporting the implementation of this peace agreement. We would like to see the European Union, World Bank, IGAD, the African Union, Arab countries and Americans. They should rally behind these efforts so we are able to achieve development.
Sam Imbrator, a resident of Al Janina town of West Darfur, has a different opinion. Speaking to South Sudan in Focus via WhatsApp from Al Janina town, Imbrator calls it a political agreement. He argues any agreement that does not include refugees and IDPs will not bring any stability in Sudan.
Our Sudanese communities need a social peace agreement in the grassroots. They need to sit and discuss their social issues that are affecting them through a dialogue. But what has been signed in Juba is a political agreement between the government and the armed groups. Refugees and IDPs in Darfur don't feel that anything that touches them have been discussed during this agreement.
Imbrator says peace deal signed in Juba also leaves out other armed groups, including the Sudan Liberation Movement Abdul Wahid faction and the SPLM North faction led by Abdulaziz Al-Hilu. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
Sudan's former state minister for labor, Stephen Arno, says the two holdout rebel groups who refuse to be part of the comprehensive peace agreement have strong forces on the ground. He says the absences of the Sudan Liberation Movement and the SPLM North faction of Abdulaziz Al-Hilu in Khartoum could present potential threats to the peace agreement aimed at ending 17 years of conflict in Sudan.
What's happening in Juba is a very commendable development, given the fact that Sudan has been in search for peace for almost 60 years, with almost 13 peace agreements signed over the past years. But again, you know, not every peace agreement could be in having the consensus of everybody. So what's happening in Juba is a conclusion of what started almost a year ago, bringing together eight factions. Some of them are armed, some are not armed, under the leadership of Sudan, they call it revolutionary forces. With some rebel groups in Darfur, and also a faction of the SPLM, because the SPLM North now is split into two. One faction led by Malik Agar, who has commendable forces in Blue Nile, or following in Blue Nile, with Yasser Arman and others, plus the SPLM North led by Abdulaziz Al-Hilu. The SPLM North under Abdulaziz Al-Hilu is not signing, but they are part of the process.
Why is the SPLM faction under Abdulaziz Al-Hilu not signing the peace agreement to end conflict in Sudan?
They are not signing because they couldn't proceed much in discussions. They were stuck on the declaration of principles where they were proposing secularism and self-determination. And they were not able to find a breakthrough. They are actually on a stalemate with the government on that matter.
Self-determination and secession are vague, if not clearly articulated. One would ask, why self-determination and which areas want to break from Sudan?
They were not very much in the definition of who is eligible or what kind of self-determination will be agreed. But if you look at the followership of the SPLM North and the Al-Hilu, most of the followers are in Southern Kordofan and Blue Nile. These are basically continuation of the SPLM of 1983. And they signed the CPA, they have the protocols for the two areas, and the protocol was not honored. Then they went into war in 2011. and they continued until 2017 when they split into two factions.
I read some of your postings on social media where you say this will be the 13th peace agreement to be signed as part of efforts to address conflict in Sudan. And you went further, questioning its legitimacy, mediation process, and the issues at hand. Could you explain?
Not every peace agreement could address or could be able to settle the issues on the ground. And we could see it clearly because so far with these 8 protocols that are to be signed or they have been initialed, 2 forces are outside this agreement. And that's in Darfur and in southern Kordofan. And these 2 forces, they have considerable military might on the ground. So I'm not questioning the legitimacy of the process itself. Although the process was brought from the African Union High Implementation Panel led by Thabo Mbeki to a bilateral arrangement between Sudan and South Sudan, the same way that the South Sudan peace agreement was mediated by Sudan. So the legitimacy is not a big question here, but the substantial elements in the agreement is what matters. Because like now, you have 8 factions around one agreement that is now initialed in Juba, with 2 others outside the agreement, and they have forces and they have issues that they consider very legitimate, such as the question of national identity of the state, issue of governance, how Sudan should be governed from their perspective is put aside. And then these 8 factions, they are going in and they have tracks. There is a Darfur track, there is the central track, there is the eastern track, there is the northern track, and there is the South Kordofan and Blue Nile track. So in terms of, you know, the process and implementation, it's going to be somehow cumbersome because the parties are many. Yeah. This is the first time in the history of peace in Sudan where you have more than 10 factions, each claiming, you know, legitimacy over issues within certain areas.
That's Stephen Arno, Sudan's former state minister for labor. Arno is the PhD student of peace studies and international relations at the United States International University in Africa. He spoke with me on Sunday via a messaging app from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. In part 2 of this interview, Arno talks about the grantors of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, Muslims reopen places of worship in South Sudan. That story is coming up after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
why do you think more young people are turning away from farming?
You know, for you to farm, to be a farmer, you have to wait. I'm waiting, and you know, these guys, they don't want to wait. They want the money now. They don't want you to maybe you plant your corn or maize or yam, and you have to wait till maybe probably like how many months before it germinates and before you can even harvest.
Maybe because they feel or they view farming to be an old occupation or vocation that are mostly for the villagers. But then I feel farming is one that I know you can generate money from.
In most cases, young people in Africa think white collar jobs are the most earning. But in the real sense, it's the reverse.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm VOA health correspondent Linor Mudu. The World Health Organization and Africa Centers for Disease Control say we all can help fight the coronavirus pandemic by wearing face masks that cover our mouths and noses when we are in crowded areas. For more information, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest news on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Muslims in the South Sudan capital Juba have welcomed the government's decision to reopen places of worship following restrictions imposed in April to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. Muslim clerics in Juba are cautioning worshippers to observe guidelines put in place by the Ministry of Health, which includes regular hand washing and social distancing. For VOA News, David Monodanga reports from Juba.
With the sound of the Adhan, or the call to Friday prayers, hundreds of Muslims flocked to Juba's Kuwait Grand Mosque. It was the first prayer service in 5 months since the government banned all religious gatherings to prevent the spread of the coronavirus in South Sudan. Muslim Abdallah Sadat Lako says he was happy and excited to hear the call for prayers on Friday, but also realistic.
COVID-19 is still there. We have to take the measures. When we came to the mosque today, a lot of people were wearing masks. That's good. Social distancing, and no shaking hands, no greeting. At least you greet someone from a far place. So we are so happy that prayers is officially open. We are afraid, but we all know that God heals and God protects. If you have your mask, you wash your hands with soap and water, you have sanitizer, you keep social distancing, you follow the measures from the Ministry of Health, I think no fears.
Leading Friday's prayers, the Imam of the mosque, Sheikh Abdallah Baraj, told the Muslim faithful to resume prayers but to take COVID-19 preventive measures seriously.
Now that we are allowed to reopen and resume our gatherings, we need to follow all directives, including wearing masks, social distance, and to avoid shaking hands at all times. Even the Holy Quran advises the Muslims to protect oneself. Therefore, let us all help in keeping these directives.
About 500 believers entered the 3,000 capacity mosque and stayed 1 meter apart inside per social distancing guidelines. Muslims who did not wear face masks were barred from entering the mosque. An aide stood at the entrance with a temperature gun, measuring each worshipper's temperature before the person was allowed to go inside. On Thursday, the Islamic Council announced the reopening of prayers after a meeting of the National Task Force on COVID-19. Sheikh Vital Aligo, deputy chair of the South Sudan Civil Society Alliance and a national COVID-19 task force member, says the task force agreed to allow religious activities to resume on condition that religious leaders enforce all coronavirus preventive measures. Aligo says the places of worship will reopen one by one since the pandemic is still dangerous, according to the medical advisory plenary of the task force.
Corona is still spreading, is still killing people, and the government is very seriously in order to save the life of the citizens. That's why all the religious leaders, they have been asked to abide by the guideline of the coronavirus.
Aligo says the medical advisory team says while Muslims are praying, the windows of mosques should remain open to prevent spread of the pandemic. During a weekly media briefing on Sunday, health ministry officials said although the number of coronavirus cases are declining in the country, citizens should remain vigilant because neighboring countries are seeing an increase in cases. Health ministry spokesperson Dr. Thaw Loy says people should continue to wear face masks in public places.
We are seeing less positive cases compared to some few weeks or some few months back. But it is also very true that the cases are increasing in our neighboring countries, mainly Uganda, with cross-border activity with the Republic of South Sudan.
South Sudan currently has 2,524 confirmed cases with 1,294 recoveries and 47 deaths, according to Dr. Loy. For VOA News, I am David Monodanga in Juba.
The UN Human Rights Office has condemned the shooting of African-American man Jacob Blake and said the use of force by police may violate international law. For VOA News, Lisa Schrein reports from Geneva.
Riots broke out in the city of Kenosha in the U.S. state of Wisconsin in the wake of Sunday's police shooting of Jacob Blake, which has left the 29-year-old African-American man partially paralyzed. The U.N. Human Rights Office views the shooting as a painful reminder of the heightened risk African-Americans run when engaging with law enforcement in the United States. Agency spokesman Rupert Colville says the episode reaffirms the need for urgent action to eradicate links between structural racism and policing.
From the images available that we've seen at this point, the police appears to use force against Jacob Blake that would seem to be excessive. And it does not appear that the law enforcement officers abided by the international standard for the intentional use of lethal force with a firearm.
A statement from the Kenosha Police Union said that based on officers' inability to gain compliance and control from Blake after using verbal, physical, and less lethal means, the officers drew their firearms. Colville says it seems highly possible the force used against Blake could be discriminatory in nature. The human rights spokesman also says he is aghast at the presence of vigilantes at the protest in Kenosha. He says he finds the killing of two people and injury of others by a 17-year-old gunman of particular concern. The teen, who took a rifle to the protest of Blake's shooting, told an online news site before going to the demonstration that it was his job to protect people. First-degree reckless homicide, first-degree intentional homicide, and attempted first-degree intentional homicide are among the criminal charges the young man is now facing.
We would see this as, you know, yet another, unfortunately, example of the insufficient and lax gun control measures in the United States, which is something we've spoken about several times before. You know, it should be inconceivable that you have a 17-year-old running around with an automatic rifle in a position to shoot people in this way in such a tense situation.
Colville says the events of the past few days in Kenosha are not only recurrent, but preventable. He warns against sending federal troops into Kenosha to restore law and order. He says their presence is likely to make things worse rather than better. In a tweet Friday, U.S. President Donald Trump said that the National Guard had successfully quelled violence and rioting in Kenosha. He said, since the National Guard moved into Kenosha, Wisconsin 2 days ago, there has been no further violence, not even a small problem. When legally asked to help by local authorities, the federal government will act and quickly succeed, the president said. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Still in the United States, thousands of people took part in a march in Washington on Friday to denounce racism on the anniversary of the march in 1963, where civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. made his historic I Have a Dream speech. VOA's Jason Patinkin was there and files this report.
People started lining up just after sunrise for their chance to take part in Friday's March on Washington in the United States Capitol. The event was full of emotions, anger, grief, resolve, and love, as thousands gathered from around the United States to protest against racism and police brutality. As the crowd sat and stood for hours in the heat, dozens of speakers took to the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in the heart of Washington, D.C., where Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his legendary I Have a Dream speech in 1963. This time, the march was billed as a commitment march to rededicate Americans to King's message of racial and economic equality at a time when open racism, economic inequality, and political violence are at levels not seen for decades in the United States. The first speaker was Mimi Taylor, an organizer of Black Lives Matter in Washington, D.C.
We must invest for the police and invest in black communities in the black community. Because in D.C., Black Lives Matter means defund the police.
A A main theme of the event, voting U.S. President Donald Trump out of office. Volunteers handed out face masks to everyone entering, printed with the words, "I will vote," and registered people to vote on the spot. Rick Hart, a Morehouse College student and member of the National Action Network, which organized Friday's march, said that the United States was at a moment of reckoning.
And we surely mustn't forget that each and every day Donald Trump and his allies stand in the way of this movement by deliberately sowing injustice and inequity along the lines of racism, xenophobia, aporophobia, and misogyny. But this upcoming election is about so much more than them. It is about electing progressive prosecutors who will fight to reform the criminal legal system. It is about electing legislators who will fight to pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Act and the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act.
Martin Luther King III, the son of the late civil rights icon, was one of the keynote speakers.
But we must never forget the American nightmare of racist violence exemplified when Emmett Till was murdered on this day in 1955 and the criminal justice system failed to convict his killers. 65 years later, we still struggle for justice, demilitarizing the police, dismantling mass incarceration, and declaring and determinedly as we can that black lives matter.
Civil rights leader Reverend Al Sharpton directed part of his speech at President Trump.
We do not want to be disrespected. How do you speak while this young man, Jacob, lies in a hospital and you won't call his name? How do you sit while Breonna Taylor's in a grave and you won't call her name? How do you sit while Eric Garner's in a grave and you won't call his name? How do you sit while George Floyd is laying in a grave and you won't call his name? Well, Mr. Trump, look right down the block from the White House. We come to Washington by the thousands. We gonna call their name. We gonna call their name. We'll never let America forget what you've done. Call their names.
Dozens of relatives of people killed by police also spoke to the crowd in the sweltering sun. Theonis Floyd, the brother of George Floyd, became emotional while he spoke.
I'm so overwhelmed right now with everybody here right now. I wish George would have seen this right now. That's what I'm marching for. I'm marching for George, for Breonna, for Ahmaud, for Jacob, for Pamela Turner, for Michael Brown, Trayvon, and anybody else who lost their lives.
There were so many families of people killed or wounded by police in attendance that there wasn't enough time for each to speak. After the speeches ended, the march continued across Washington, D.C. It was not the first, and surely not the last, protest for racial justice in America. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Washington.
That's our show for this Monday. We now leave you with the song "My Country" by Lonely Boy from Bidibidi Refugee Camp in Uganda.
Na na na. We back again, lonely boy, the master. We back again, and I'm busy killing
Junub Sudan.
I am a team
Junub Sudan,
my country
Junub Sudan,
Ghana school
Junub Sudan,
and I'm busy killing
Junub Sudan.
I am a team
Junub Sudan,
my country
Junub Sudan,
Ghana school
Junub Sudan,
and I'm a replay. Nas getiri mabiru dubeleto Mwondi haliso Kamandi sitimu Malu Juno Sudan De beleta masakila po Gebeli ya fogo Kamandi ya fogo Mi Malis papa Itakandrua bideleta zo.
We have been listening to Lonely Boy with the song "My Country". I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for being part of our evening. Remember to wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers, because there is no cure for coronavirus. Join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
No,